Support for Refined by Fire comes from Elkhart Brass. Elkhart Brass is a new sponsor on the show. And when we talk about Elkhart, we can talk about a lot of things. We talk about Made in America. We talk about Elkhart Brass rocking out since 1902, or the wide variety of product application. But I'm not going to do any of that. I'm going to tell you that we're repping Elkhart Brass on this show and taking them on as a sponsor because we believe that Elkhart truly has the best interest of the end user in mind. In a world of gimmicks and sales pitches that is fire service vendors, Elkhart is making nozzles and appliances that are truly firefighter focused, and they believe that their products speak for themselves, and I have to agree. If your committee or your department is looking to make a purchase of nozzles and appliances, go to elkhartbrass.com, find your dealer, and hit them up. Lastly, stay tuned at the end of the show. We're going to have a special little piece from Elkhart Brass for everyone to check out. Here we are at episode 4 of Refined by Fire, a Brothers in Battle media production. This is a very late episode 4. My apologies for the delay. We are still going to consider this the September episode, and we're working at cranking out an October episode so that we kind of stay on schedule here and can keep pursuing this project of documenting a living history of the fire service. My guest here on episode 4 of Refined by Fire is Rob Fisher. Rob's a good friend, a guy who's become a senior man to me in the last couple years. He is a lieutenant and training officer with Snohomish County District 7, just north of Seattle, and a 29-year vet of the fire service. Rob's like one of those guys who kind of just seems to have his hands on everything. A lot of regional projects and organizations, a lot of national projects and organizations. He is the education trustee for the Fools International. He's been involved with his local chapter, the Puget Sound Fools, for over 15 years, and he's an FDIC presenter. He's got a class, I think the proper name is Quint Considerations for the Single Truck Suburban Department. So if you are going to FDIC in 2018, you're in one of those smaller departments, 3, 4, 5 stations, and you've only got one truck, this is a really great class for you to take, whether that's a straight truck or a Quint. Rob's probably got a lot that he could impart to you. So Rob also is an instructor with Washington State Fire Academy and Brothers in Battle. We really had a great time. We covered a lot of ground in this talk. So without explaining it any further, we'll just get it started. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Here's my talk with Rob Fisher. Okay, I'm here with Rob Fisher. Rob, thanks for being here.
Thanks, brother.
Yeah, man, it's good to talk to you. All right, Rob, so you're always hitting up the social media with your traveling photos. You're always making me full of wanderlust. So where are you coming to me from today?
We are in Seattle, Washington. I'm at home today. It's Friday and my day off from work. Wife is working from home as well, and we're just kicking it here in the condo, and I'm looking forward to our talk today.
I like it. Sounds good. Well, truth be told, in all transparency, we've done this once before, haven't we?
We did try it once before.
Yeah, we had a little bit of technical issues, so I'm stoked to be doing it again. Enjoyed it last time, and I think we're really going to do it even better this time. So I just want to jump right into it. You mentioned Seattle. Seattle is obviously the Puget Sound area, and you are one of the founding members of the Puget Sound Fools. So, and in addition to being on the Fools International Board. So, Rob, can you tell us what the Fools is, why you're involved, et cetera?
Well, first of all, I just clarify, I'm not one of the founding members of the Puget Sound Fools.
I'm trying to give you credit here.
I appreciate it. And I will take all the credit I can. I need that sometimes. The Puget Sound Pool started in 2001, right after 9/11. And I didn't get involved into the chapter until 2002. And it was kind of an interesting story. We went to several of us, primarily my driver, Chad Berg, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about him throughout the show, but we were down in Sacramento for FDIC West. Now, most people know of FDIC being in Indianapolis, and there was a time when there was an FDIC East, and they would go to New Jersey, and then there was an FDIC West, which was in California somewhere. But in 2002, we went to FDIC West, and we were doing a truck class as students, and there was this haggard-looking guy that was, you know, he was one of those guys that you looked up to, had a really cool mustache, kind of like the one you have. And his name was Kevin Trost. He was a captain on Truck 7, Sac City. And here's this group of firemen, and we're getting ready to go over some ventilation operations. And I remember the building. It was one of those, like, 1950s California-style apartment buildings with the pea gravel on the top, you know, like a really relaxed angle roof, almost flat, but it wasn't flat. And he said, "Who here is a fool?" And we all kind of looking at each other going, "What the hell is he talking about?" And he talked a little bit about the fools, and he says, "You know what? We'll save that for after the training. If you want to talk about fools, you know, see me up and we'll see you at the pub." And we did the training. It was awesome. We met Bob Pressler, who was there. And so it was just like, it was this really cool thing. And then come that night when we were doing the social event, you know, we found out what the Fools was about. And basically the Fools started in 1995, some Florida firemen. It actually started in FDIC in the basement of a hotel, of a group of firemen getting together. But it was about preserving the traditions. It was about training. It was about, you know, rallying a group of firefighters, women and men. And that, you know, just, you know, there is a brother and sisterhood, and just, you know, capturing that and keeping it for the fire service. So, you know, after 2002, my driver and I, we said, this is us. You know, this is what we believe in. And, man, let's start one of these things. And we came back to find out that Puget Sound Pools had already been started by some other guys I used to teach with. I didn't even realize they had started it. And so we joined. And, we, you know, from there, basically kind of giving you the history where I'm at now, I was an e-board member for a period of time on the Puget Sound Pools, secretary, training guy. We hosted the International Fools Convention in 2008 in Seattle. It was a huge hit. That year, in 2008, I received the Dana Hannon Award, which is an award given to the fool that shows a strong passion for training their brother and sister firefighters. So from there, you know, I was very active in the chapter, and about 2012, the founders of the Fools asked if I would be interested in job shadowing with Captain Mike Dugan, who was the training trustee of the International. And if you don't know Mike Dugan, look him up on the internet. He's quite the figure, so I hung out with Mike Dugan, learning about what he does, and in 2013 or somewhere in there, I became the training trustee, so Mike could retire, and now we actually call it the education chair. So I've been the education chair for the International since about 2013.
That's excellent. You mentioned Dana Hannon, and we are going to touch on that here in a little bit, and I want to ask a few more things about the Fools, but what did you learn from Captain Dugan? What was it like to, how long did you kind of work under him, and what did you learn from him specifically? Because he's a big figure in the fire service.
You know, the thing that I learned from Dugan, and it really it goes to the Fools just in general, is that Rich Nappy, who was a FDNY guy, and he was killed in the line of duty a few years back, and he was a very active Fools member. But a lot of these, because when you look at FDNY, you think, man, these guys are bigger than life, especially people like Dugan. And really, they're like each one of us. You know, they put their pants on one leg at a time. And the thing that I got from Dugan is everybody is the same. We all are looking for the same things, you know, that have the same interest in the Fools. And we talked about training issues. We talked about, because as part of my job as the education chair is help facilitating other chapters with their training. Do they have any problems with training? What are the problems they're having? The big issue always comes up is insurance and how do we protect ourselves? And Dugan taught me a lot about just, you know, getting your own policies and we see Dugan all the time and he's not left the international. I mean, he's actually one of the Fools Emeritus, or Founder Emeritus, I guess is what they're calling it. And so I still work with Dugan. In fact, we'll be working together for the 2018 convention training side of things, which it's coming back to Seattle. Puget Sound's going to be the first chapter to host a second convention in the history of the Fools. And so we still work together on a lot of things. I can always go to Mike with any problem. He loves the fire service, and he loves the brothers and sisters of the fire service.
That's cool. What a cool opportunity. I didn't realize it was coming back to Seattle. That's pretty fantastic. When is the international convention, just for folks maybe to kind of pencil it in on their calendar?
Well, I wish I knew the exact date. I know it's going to probably be in September of 2018. You know, really the convention it's kind of like a moving target. Every year, you know, we open it up to all the chapters in the international. They bid for it 2 years out, and then the year out they give an update of what's going on. Usually by the year out they give the actual date. The Seattle convention, nobody had put in for 2018, and there had been a lot of talk about this will be the 10th anniversary since it was in Seattle in 2008, and so Seattle or Puget Sound kind of got into it late. I know that they're shooting for September because just with tourism here in Seattle, and it just wouldn't work, and we want to make sure we give a good show and that there's good weather here for when people travel. So look for September 2018. It will be out here in the next month or two.
That's fantastic. Seattle in September is going to be pretty amazing.
It will.
That's a cool city. Well, very good. We've talked about this a little bit before. I originally hooked up with you with some questions about the Fools, and we hooked up on the phone. You're always really gracious with your time. And I appreciate that. I just wanted to, you know, give you, I don't know, some thanks for that, for taking the time for a guy like me a few years back to help me with my my local chapter here in the Boise area. You know, so why should someone join the Fools? Like, if you're a listener, how do you evangelize, or should you evangelize to get guys and girls to join the Fools?
Well, you know, I would say the Fools are not searching for members. Being a Fool is not for everybody, and because you're not a Fool doesn't mean that you're not a good fireman, or you're not good at your job, or you don't have passion for your job. So I would say if you love the fire service, you find that you spend equal amount of time away from work doing it that you do at work. You find that a lot of your friends are Fools member, or I'm sorry, not Fools members, but are into the fire service, into the job like you are. then probably The Fools is for you, and it's just something that you should look into. But we're not trying to recruit people. There's no need to bring people in, because, you know, we're looking for quality, not quantity.
Very good. I like that. I like that take. I hadn't thought of it like that before you presented it that way. And you know, that's okay. It's okay for something not to be for everyone. And The Fools is great. So if that sounds like something, you know, people are interested in, I definitely encourage them to look up their local chapter.
Steven, I would say that the other thing is, Fools meetings are open to anybody. I mean, they shouldn't be closing their meetings unless it was something special. But for the most part, every chapter that I know, when they have a Fools meeting, they're doing some business for their chapter, but they're also doing training, and it's just a brother or sisterhood, you know, making connection. And you can go to Fools meetings and hang out and learn and everything and be a part of it and never really ever have to sign up. Now, the benefits of being a Fool is you finally get to say, hey, I subscribe to the same thing that these brothers and sisters do. And you have to be a Fool's member to be able to attend convention.
Okay. Very good. Thanks for clarifying that. All right. So you said you started to dig into The Fools like late 2000. You and Chad Berg, your driver there in Snohomish. That was after you guys returned from a trip to New York City post 9/11 in December of 2001. Tell me the story of like how you guys ended up going to FDNY in 2001, and you know, kind of what was behind that, and what motivated that, and what did you learn from that kind of long term?
So after 9/11, we had just hired a group of firefighters. We had a probie class, and at one of I think it was one of the union meetings. They wanted to do something to help raise money for the families, knowing that, you know, the amount of loss and how long it's going to take to support the families. So they designed a T-shirt, a blue T-shirt with white silk screen print. It was basically a simple Maltese cross logo. You know, it had, I'm trying to remember what was on the chest, but it had something like, FDNY 9/11 or September 11th, 2001. And they were basic shirts, and we sold these shirts and these shirts sold. And it was just like, it was this incredible movement that ended up happening where other organizations were calling up and saying, hey, we would love to help sell your shirts. Can we order up 200 T-shirts? And after, oh, I don't know, it was December that we went there, but it was some point in probably in November that the decision was made that we have a decent amount of money, we have a checkbook, and we're going to go back to New York. We're going to attend funerals, and we're going to handwrite a cash check to family members so that they can help take care of whatever their needs. I want to say we had probably somewhere right around $30,000-$40,000 that we had made from these T-shirts in a short period of time. We arrived in New York on a red eye flight. The first funeral that we were doing was a captain out of Tower Ladder 35, Frank Callahan, right in Lincoln Center area. We basically walked into the station. Guys were going, we're a Snohomish County. And so we tell them they can't believe that we flew all the way out for a funeral of one of their brothers. We were in the procession. We go to the, you know, the reception afterwards. And while at the reception, we run into these guys that are asking, one, where we're from. We tell them, they're just amazed. And they ask which firehouse we're staying in. We said, oh, no, we're staying at the Embassy Suites or whatever we were staying at. Like, no, there's no way. You guys don't come this distance and you don't stay in a fire. You guys are going to stay with us. And we said, well, where's your station at? We're on the other side of Broadway. You know, we're basically in a pretty shitty neighborhood is what it was. And it was the company of Ladder 34, Engine 84. And so we got invited and they were going to be working that night. And so they said, come on out. And we got out of our hotel. We hailed a cab to go across town. The cabbie, being a Middle Eastern guy, he saw us in our Class A's and he said, hey, I'm going to take you there for free. Thank you guys for what you do. And it was, that was a surreal moment, I tell you, with everything that had been going on.
Wow. Yeah.
And we pull up to this shitty ass neighborhood, tenements all over the place, you know, the fire station. You can tell it's a fire station, but you know, you would never know by looking down the block. Knock on the door, and here are these brothers, and we hooked up with them. They took us all over the place. We went to a number of different funerals. We wrote a lot of checks, and that was the beginning of a very long relationship with a bunch of brothers out of that firehouse. And what is even a strange connection is Ladder 34 is the company that Dana Hannon worked on. And then it would come full circle in 2008 that, holy shit, can you believe that? I want to say that overall we raised like $130,000 or $140,000 after a year's worth of selling t-shirts. They went back three or four times. And then at the very end, it had probably been at least a year. We flew out, eight of those guys, put them up in a hotel downtown Seattle and had them here for several days and just had a lot of brotherhood with them. What I learned was we're all the same. You know, it was an incredible connection with people we had no clue, never even had any relationship before. And just, you know, we could sit there and have a beer and talk. And they cared. You know, I work for the small Snohomish County Fire Department that goes on, I don't know, 4,000 calls at that time, 4,000 or 5,000 calls a year out of a couple stations. And these guys are seeing work on a regular basis. And they had no problem talking to me. They had no problem talking about them. And it wasn't one of those things like, let me tell you what a fire is like, kid. It was just being good people and talking.
That's beautiful, Rob. That's a beautiful work that you guys did to raise money to give to widows. It's a really beautiful coincidence, if you want to call it that. I mean, I don't know. I think it's such a cool thing that you stayed in the firehouse of one of those men who died on 9/11, and then, you know, 7 years later you were presented with that award with his name on it. It's almost like too good to be true, and
like a higher power,
right? And, you know, I mean, look, you can believe what you want to believe. I tend to believe that there is something. I do believe that there is something working that's bigger than us, and I don't know, man, things like that don't necessarily seem very coincidental to me, but regardless of what you believe, it's beautiful. And the connection you made with those guys, it was like a lot like what you were just saying about Captain Dugan. You know, we're all the same, and sure, definitely I elevate a lot of those people in a lot of those departments where they go to work day in and day out, things that I'm not doing, but we're all preparing to be the same person on the same job, you know, when we're called upon. I think that's really amazing.
You know, and another thing that I think the very first place that I learned that you called somebody a brother and you actually hugged another guy, a friend, you know, somebody that you worked with, was back then. It was a result of 9/11. And the fools have always said brother. Now, again, you know, 2001, I didn't know really know anything about the fools. It wasn't until 2002. So here I'm back at FDNY, and we're talking to these guys, and they're calling me brother. I'm like, how do they know that, you know, what's that connection? Well, the connection is I wear a helmet similar to theirs, you know, because we don't wear leather helmets, but I wear a helmet similar to theirs. I make the same sacrifices they do, maybe not as often as they do, but I'm willing to step up and do the things that they're doing just the same. And so because of that, I am a brother or a sister. And I was getting hugs from these guys that was just like, oh, never met you before, but hey, brother. And that, I mean, now I look at where we're at now. all the time. You know, we come to the fire station, we're coming on shift, and you haven't seen the guys you work with for, you know, 5 days or whatever the period of time is. And it's like, hey, brother, how you doing? You give them a hug. That just wasn't that just didn't happen back in, you know, prior to 9/11, at least in my fire department.
I like that. Is that perpetuating? Do you think that is something that's continuing? Have you seen that, you know, at the same level since 9/11?
Absolutely. I think we've lost some things since 9/11, but, you know, I would say that the understanding of brother and sister, brotherhood, sisterhood, and I think that, at least in my area, I think that sustains. Now, there are times that some might say, hey, that right there, they are a fireman versus a fire service employee that just comes in and punches the clock and goes home. And you might not always call that guy a brother or that girl a sister, but everybody else that, you know, they're engaged in their job, they care about what they do, they want to make things better in their communities. Oh, absolutely. I call them a brother until they've, you know, proven otherwise that they shouldn't earn that right.
I love it. That's great. 9/11 is one of those defining moments, obviously, in the fire service, but we all have kind of small defining moments in our own individual careers and in our own agencies and areas. You had one of those in March of 2014 with the Oso mudslide. And I guess just to give a little bit of context, obviously I don't know it inside and out, but this was a huge event that happened in March of 2014, like 43 people killed, 49 structures destroyed. You responded as a member of the tech rescue team from Snohomish. Can you tell us a little bit about that incident and like what it's like to work on an incident of that scale?
Yeah. My son and his wife are in town. Wife now, they were in town visiting, and we were out at lunch, and the event occurred on the Saturday, I believe is what it was, the 22nd, and it happened, and it was initially, they were trying to figure out what it was, and then the deployment of the county rescue team came the next morning. Or early morning, and we were just going out to lunch, and so I ended up getting deployed up there. What occurred was, you have to be in the air to see the magnitude. But basically, this area of homes, like you said, there was 49, 50 homes, kind of like a horseshoe type design, where there was a highway that kind of that went through the middle of it, homes on both sides. Then there was a river on one side, and on the other side of the river was a huge, huge hill. I won't call it a mountain, but maybe in some places it would be considered a mountain. But that hill gave way, came down, slid through the river, essentially turning it into a tsunami, and then came across and wiped out all 50 of those homes. And you know, I had to look it up because I knew we were probably going to talk about it. But the estimation from the geologist, it was over 10 million cubic yards of earth that flowed through the river, wiped the river out essentially, and it became 30 to 70 feet of mud over the top of this neighborhood. We got there, like I said. The picture that most people see when they look it up is this house in the middle of the highway, and that's where we started our operation. Huge, huge zone, and we're talking square miles. And we stood at the end of that debris going, what the fuck happened? You know, and trying to understand it. And we found a lady in that home. You know, we quickly searched that home, and we extricated her from the home, and when we later found that that was the wife to one of the local firefighters. Wow. And the granddaughter was in that same home. So It took us, I don't remember the exact amount of time, but it took us probably well over a week, if not 10 days, almost 2 weeks, to finally find the granddaughter in the, you know, in the slurry of everything. And I'll tell you, that day, because we had been looking for a long time, and that day when we had just started the morning, it had been raining. I mean, it was miserable, this work that everybody's doing. And so that you guys understand it, I wasn't in the trenches. I got to be a div soup and, you know, a division. Basically, I was a division leader. And so I was handing out all the assignments, and we were gritting off the areas that we're searching and trying to organize everything up. And so where I was situated was in these tents on the highway, right where that house was, or right near where the house was. And the DOT had been clearing the highway slowly, you know, going through the debris, the mud and everything. And it was freaking pouring down rain this day. We just gave out the assignments. So several squads were going out to start digging. And it was probably about 20 minutes into everything. And one of the workers from the DOT said, "Hey, we found Snowy," which is the granddaughter. Like, "You got to be kidding me." He's like, "Yeah, she's right over here." And they had been digging with a backhoe, with a, you know, and it's just incredible how this happened. And as they were moving earth away and they were scooping it up and moving in, Snowy popped out of this area, kind of like in a pool of mud. And so they shut down the machine, and there was still a lot of activity going on in the command post area, or in our division area. And I said, "You got to be kidding me." He goes, no, we found her. And I said, "Just pretend like the machine is broken. Let's figure out what we're going to do here. And because I don't want to cause any major commotion." We contacted Seth, who was the grandfather, and Seth's daughter, who was the mother of the child, and got them to the scene. And it was just, I just can't even tell you how incredible it was. But we got her out of the mud, wiped her off a little bit, wrapped her in one of those ambulance blankets, and gave her to her mom, and she was so happy to have her daughter. She looked pristine, you know. There was no trauma, nothing. She just looked pristine. Just life had been taken from her, and that's all it was. And that was the cap of everything, you know. From there on out, we were a part of locating the 43 victims. And what's another amazing thing is, every single victim was located that was lost in this multi-square mile area of, you know, anywhere from, like I said, 30 to 70 feet of mud. And
that's really unbelievable. That's really, if you have any idea of what the scale of what 10 million cubic tons is, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible. And you know, a lot of it is, you know, there was the hard work of a lot of volunteers. It was the work of not just Snohomish County Technical Rescue Team, FEMA Washington Task Force 1 worked the East Division. We worked the West Division. We were released by California Task Force 7, which is out of Sacramento, Sac City. Volunteers of the community, volunteers that, you know, it was the first time, from what I understand, it was the first time that FEMA had allowed an open scene and allowed volunteers in to help out.
Wow.
And it worked because it kept a good tie to OSO, the community, to this. I mean, it allowed them to heal. I worked the incident for probably 3 weeks. I stayed up. My driver lives up that area, so I stayed at my driver's house the entire time. Came home once for a night's sleep at home, and to, you know, re-energize and be with the wife. Went back up there, finished up my time. We did the transition with California Task Force 7, and then I went to FDIC and was there, and never really went back. Now, resources were there for well over a month and doing things. But yeah, I can't even describe it. you know, really. Never been to anything big like this, but it was quite an incredible, surreal incident.
You mentioned like going home and recharging a little bit. I mean, you find yourself, you said you were in the command post, you weren't digging. But did you find yourself, or did you find the men and women working for you? You find yourself frustrated or even angry, or, you know, were you finding any of those effects of like PTSD, like at the time?
I guess, you know, I just recently finished my peer support training, and I'm getting on board with being able to recognize that, because obviously we have a significant problem in the fire service with firefighter suicide. But having been through that training now, and, you know, kind of looking back, we were all aware that everybody was under various levels of stress. It just all depend on, you know, how your day went, you know, and as most firefighters know, the horror that we see, you know, the horrific things that we deal with, some of our greatest successes is just being able to find somebody dead or alive,
yeah.
You know, but just, so when we would have when we would locate, a victim, that was, I mean, everybody was on cloud nine, and that was, so they were dealing with highs and lows and highs and lows and going back and forth. You know, I don't think there was any time at night, because we would stop operations at night. We wouldn't work the pile at night, but I don't think people were, you know, out numbing themselves, and, you know, they came back to work early in the morning, ready to work. But you could see there was a level of stress. Following the incident, I can assure you there is even members on my team that it's left an impact. You know, it is a scar that they will have for the rest of their life. I mean, we all have different intensities of it, but there are some in my organization that I would say it had an impact, a huge impact in their life. But, you know, the other thing I wanted to say, because the guys and gals did incredible amount of work, but the technology was amazing. They were able to fly over the scene. They were able to use you know, hydraulics and figure out how the earth would move with this amount of water, and estimated with this amount of dirt, and where everybody was laid out, where the houses were laid out, what type of current you would have. And they gave us a map, like, I don't know, after week one, saying there's a high probability that a victim will be in this area right here. Wow, really? You think so? And this victim that was in this house will probably be here. And I, you know, I'll be damned, but they were pretty nuts on. Wow. It was incredible. So there was a lot of hard work of digging and hand digging and going through all the debris, but a lot of it was tagged by technology that, you know, they brought in that helped us out a lot. So
that's really cool. Again, I'm so impressed that you were able to find all 43 victims. That's a matter of an intense desire, I think, paired with some great technology, some very capable people. It's very cool.
Absolutely.
Talked a little bit about the impact that had on people, the scars, right, that we carry. And, you know, I don't think that's something we can ever solve. I think we're always going to be scarred by what we do. And I think that's part of what makes this job great and also very difficult sometimes. You've been involved with a program called Rosecrans Florian. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
What can you tell me about Rosecrans Florian and why you're involved in it?
The Rosecrans Florian project. Are you still there, brother?
Yeah, I'm here. You got me?
Okay. Yep. I just heard a blip, and I didn't know if maybe I lost you there for a second. So, the Rosecrans Florian Project is it was started by a battalion chief out of Chicago Fire, Dan DeGrice. He's a clinician himself. He has dealt with stress and in himself in his own life, And so he recognized there was a problem going on in the Chicago Fire Department and looking at their data. So working with Rosecrans, which is a hospital in the Illinois area, he wanted to create a wing that was dedicated just to the troubles for firemen, firefighters that from all around the country. And they did that. So at the Rosecrans Florian wing, it's dedicated, you know, it specializes in firefighter addictions and stresses and PTSD and everything that goes along with it. Fools International got hooked up with Rosecrans a few years back. They do a symposium. This September will be the second annual symposium. We went to the first one last year. I'm going again this year. The Fools have kind of said, hey, we need to, if we're going to do something for our brothers and sisters, we really need to hang our hat on something. And I think that is right now with the epidemic that's going on with, you know, firefighter suicide, that's where we're at. So we've hooked up with Rosecrans. You need help, you can reach to them. They'll bring you in. You can stay in their facility. They'll get you the treatment you need. We try to raise money for them so that we can reduce the cost down to, you know, hopefully zero, and you get the needed treatment that you need. So it's a great program.
It sounds really great. I applaud the Fools for being involved and you for being involved. And I'm really, I guess, pleased to see kind of the shift and the focus that's being put on these types of issues in the fire service. I've been helping guys and girls in the last, you know, year or two with interviews. You know, they're just people who volunteer here at Eagle or folks that I know, you know, we'll talk if they're trying to get hired, and I'll help them with a mock interview. And one of those typical questions is like, what's the least appealing thing about becoming a firefighter, or the least appealing thing about the fire service? You know, my answer for that is obviously like the exposure to PTSD, the reality that we're 100% more likely to get cancer than, you know, someone in the general population, and this focus on mental performance, mental health is really important, and I'm really pleased at what I've seen, you know, the focus being put on that. So applaud the Fools for doing that. And I don't know, man, what's what else can we do? I mean, is there something we're missing, you know, like day to day, whether it's in the firehouse, whether it's in academy, is there something we can do to try and be a little more proactive? You know, I mean, you've been in the fire service a long time. You have any insight to that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, first of all, if you get online and look up the name Rick George and his resilience training, Rick's going to actually be lecturing at Rosecrans this September. You know, I think what we've missed, the fire service has evolved a lot since, you know, when I was a kid and I wanted to be a fireman. And there's been a lot of changes. There's been a lot of changes in society. You know, if you look back to the 50s, relationships in homes between a husband and wife, it is different today than it was back in the 50s. It was acceptable for, you have a rough day at work. The man was the one that worked, of course. You had a rough day at work. You call your wife if she answers the phone. There's no pagers. There's no cell phones. There's no answering machines. You call her and you tell her, you know what? I'll be home when I'm home. And you go to the bar with your brothers and you guys hash out a bad call. And you probably drive home drunk. Again, the laws were different, so you could get pulled over. The cop's like, oh, let me help you out, John. Let me get you back home. You know, it was acceptable for you to come home and maybe be abusive to your wife, and physically and mentally. And that was the way we dealt with things. The world has changed. I mean, whoever thought that somebody would steal a jetliner full of people and crash it into a building? Whoever thought you would get into a van and just drive down the frickin' sidewalk plowing over people? So the horrors of just society today have now escalated. What we deal with is a lot different. And our environment that we come home to, it's not okay for you to come home and smack your wife around. I tell you what, maybe your wife is working and you're the one at home and you're not the firefighter. Our rules are changing a little bit. What's acceptable has changed. So we have to figure out another way of handling this, you know, a more appropriate way of handling it. And we have to realize that it's okay to have a bad day. It's okay to have stress. It's okay, you know, to talk to somebody and say, man, I just don't feel right after this call. That's okay. You know, you're not weak. You're human. You're freaking human being. And it takes freaking nutcases that are not remorseful for some of the horrors that happen, you know, that you have. If you're a human being and you're really compassionate for mankind, human beings, when you see something as horrific as we see sometimes, it's going to take a toll on you. So the one thing I would say preventatively is, you know, I don't know about your recruit class, but we never talked about this stuff. We never talked about, you know, under controlling your emotions, and I don't mean controlling it as in you can't have emotions, but how are your emotions going to have an impact on you? What things can you do to help yourself out? You know, what resources are there when you have a bad day? Because I tell you what, if you've been in the fire service more than 5 years, you're going to have a bad freaking day. So what I would like to see is, and this is a lot what Rick George talks about, is from the very beginning when you join the fire service, I think some of the greatest departments, one of the things they do is before you even start the academy, bring in your partner, you know, husband, wife, whatever, bring them in. Let's talk about what the fire service is about. Let's let your partner know that, you know what, they may be irritable. They may come home and they can't sleep. They may be having nightmares. They may be just high on life one time, you know, and ready just to rock the world. But that is the reality of our profession. So one, we need to start doing that, letting the families know roughly what to expect. Accept the fact that our job is high risk, and there comes a lot of shit with it, and that, you know, it's not like your everyday job. And then in recruit training, we need to start doing, have an element of that addresses these things, that talks about PTSD, that talks about how to deal with things. And it just doesn't stop there. It needs to be continuing education. That's one thing that with this peer support that I'm looking forward to is not only helping out my brothers and sisters that might be in need of somebody to talk to, but the ongoing education every single day, but, you know, some way that we're going to present things that they're thinking about these things. That's what I think would help out.
Yeah, I like it. I think starting at the beginning, of course, is the best way to be proactive. Thanks for that, Rob. I appreciate your insight on that. You know, the work you've done with the Fools, the work you do there in Snohomish, even being an instructor with Brothers in Battle or at FDIC, you know, there's a lot of different ways to go about it. And the way that I hope to go about it and something I've learned from guys like yourself is that being an instructor is really serving the student, and this idea of servant leadership. And I know it's something that you've really dug into fairly deeply. So I wonder if you can define that and what that looks like practically, what servant leadership looks like practically in your life and then, like, ideally in the fire service.
Yeah. Part of my undergrad studies, well, it was in emergency management and public safety, but it was also an element. I went through Grand Canyon University, and it was Ken Blanchard School of Business. And Ken Blanchard he's one of the leading names out there when it comes to talking about leadership. And that was specifically the reason why I went there to get my degree. So we talked a lot about servant leadership. We talked a lot about an emotional intelligence, Daniel Goleman. And basically what it comes down to, servant leadership is basically service before self. So as a leader, the first thing you are concerned with is servicing others, making sure that your people that are working with you and for you are taken care of, their needs are taken care of. Kind of like you look at Maslow's hierarchy, that if we take care of all these basic needs, everything else, it's easier, right? So if I make sure that my people know that they are my number one priority, if I show that and I actually do that, then they in turn are going to give to the customer, in this case our taxpayers, they're going to give the customer the greatest amount of service. And there are companies out there that have been using servant leadership for a long time. Southwest Airlines, a lot of people, especially firemen, love to fly Southwest Airlines. It's inexpensive and it's great service. And where did that great service come from? It comes from the men and women that are the boots on the ground that take care of you. And why do they do that? You know, they do that because their company puts them first, period. And that's what I, you know, as a company officer, and, you know, that's what I'm always shooting for. And again, going back to being human, you're not perfect. And sometimes you miss it. And sometimes you get, you know, all the wood on the bat, on the ball, and you hit a home run. And so always striving to take care of my people.
I like that. I like that example of Southwest Airlines. I've read a little bit. It's Herb Kelleher. Is that right? The name of the CEO, or the founder, I should say, of Southwest Airlines. Interesting dude.
Yeah. Southwest, Starbucks. I know, like, you know, if Aaron Fields is listening, he's probably rolling his eyes because he hates Starbucks coffee. But
it's a pretty good Starbucks book, though. Onward by Howard Schultz was a pretty good book.
Yeah. I didn't read his book, but I, you know, part of my studies, we looked at Starbucks a lot. We looked at Southwest Airlines. Nordstrom is another good example, a Seattle family-run company on clothing. But there's a number of companies out there that have adopted the kind of like the essence of the servant leadership model, and I think it's proven itself. It's proven itself. It doesn't matter if you're looking in the fire service, you're looking in business or whatever. But if you just think of, you know, how do you feel as a person when somebody really cares about you and somebody is looking out for your best interests and, you know, tells you, man, you do a great job, or, you know, they help you in any way. It makes you feel good. And if anything, you're willing to do more for that person every single time.
Yep.
But it's got to be genuine. You cannot try to fake it, because you'll get away for a little bit, and then when you're caught, you'll never be able to get that back. You know, so it's got to be genuine.
So let's try and lay out a couple of examples, and you can either give it like a just kind of a best case scenario, or, you know, if you have examples from real life, that would be obviously even better. You work in training. So as an instructor, like a kind of a task level instructor, like teaching forcible entry, like we do with Brothers in Battle, how does one serve the student as opposed to serving themselves as an instructor?
Well, first of all, you know, I think you make them feel comfortable that they're there, and you don't separate yourself as I'm an instructor and you are a student. And
so humility, you know, every right starts with humility.
Yeah, absolutely. And because everybody comes at education, or comes this with varying levels. And so you have to be able to be versatile enough that you can read people. Again, this goes back to, these are elements of emotional intelligence as well. That you can read people, understand people. And so the first, you know, like I said, the first thing is, like, I want them to feel like I am just like them. I also want to show them that I am a student too, and that I don't profess to be an expert in any field when it comes to firefighting. I know earlier when you were talking, the subject matter expert on Quint, so I, you know, I might be writing a lot or doing a lot with that, but I'm by by far, I'm not no expert in this. You know, I'm just a good student of it, and I'm sharing my experiences. So, you know, humility, I think you also are looking at just, I guess, showing them that you're just like them. And then when it comes to the actual going through the skill set as encouragement, you know, because there's going to be some times that it doesn't go so well. No big deal. You know, this is why we're here. This is why we're practicing. And then thanking them at the very end of the day. So we got, you're encouraging them when they do well. You give them the high fives. You know, you get excited with them because they've accomplished something that, you know, was you know, really cool or whatever they ended up doing. And then at the very end of the day, and I think Cody does a great job in our classes, and he's wrapping everything up, is just that we are just like you. And it goes back to Cody having the history from FDNY. You know, it goes back to we are no different than you guys are. All we are is just a road show that's going around sharing our experiences. You know, you now are, we're all the same. Just continue sharing this experience that you have and continue trying. And we are learning ourselves. So, I mean, I think that's what really helps us out, you know, when dealing with students through education.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel that for sure. Cody, as you mentioned, is Cody Trestero, one of the founders of Brothers in Battle, and kind of one of the more humble servant leaders I've ever been around. So I like that you brought him up. Does that change, or are the principles are the same, but what about the practice in the firehouse for either a company officer or a battalion chief? What does servant leadership look like on a daily basis?
Company officer and battalion chief, a little bit different. Company officer, servant leadership is, you know, not only am I using that with my company and those that are working with me, but because you are tied to the customer more as a lieutenant or as a company officer, I'm actually serving the customer too. So, you know, the one thing about a company officer, they say that it's kind of the filter of shit coming down and the troubles going up. And helps to organize the day, which is true, because as a company officer, you are delivering that same service as your firefighters. So with my firefighters in the fire station, I want to know how their day was. You know, if it's been, we're coming back from our 5-day, how's the family? How was your 5-day? What were you doing? Of course, what we eat together, you know, we were going to break bread and, you know, I want to take care of their needs early in the morning. It's like, what do you need to get done today? Put their above mine, unless, of course, it comes from a higher power than me that says, hey, this will get done today. And then I'm always going to go to the extreme to protect my people. And because they've never given me a reason not to, I have no doubt that when something's happening, I'm standing up for them first before I'm standing up for anybody else. And sometimes that means you're gonna take a scar, but I think it's important. Now, from the BC level, it's a little bit different because you really don't have the interaction with the customer as you do. Your customers are those that you are you are in charge of, and I would do the same thing. It's like, I'm going to make sure that my company officers know that I truly support them in everything that they're doing. I'm going to give them every opportunity to do whatever they want through the day. I'm going to go and see them a lot. You know, nothing drives me nuts more than having a BC that I only see on a call, or I get a call from them on the phone that says, hey, this report didn't get done. Oh, okay, no problem. Thanks, Chief. Bye. But the chiefs that actually go out and visit their guys and gals on a regular basis, you know, they don't have to be there for a half an hour because it gets uncomfortable sometimes in the firehouse, but just tying in with them. How are you doing? How's things going today? Coming to a call that they didn't go on, you know, some of them are like, what? Are they here watching me because I'm not doing right? No, just want to make sure your needs are met and what can I do to help you guys out? You know, even if it is just getting the gurney from the medic unit. And, you know, and having been a temporary battalion chief before, they're like, hey, chief, I got this. So do I, man. So do I. I can do this. I can help you guys out. And so it's the same, but it's a little bit different because of the impact that it has on the customer, I think.
Yeah, I love that. All right, we're talking about Battalion Chief. You know, here at Refined by Fire, we're all about stories. So you've been working your butt off to try to promote and obtain that position of Battalion Chief. And recently you found out that your name was not called in the most recent promotion. And that's something that a lot of people listening have gone through or are going to go through. So I wonder if you can give me like a little background about that, and specifically how you stay on task, how you stay on target, how you find the good when, you know, guys like us, we work hard, we expect to attain that goal. And when it doesn't happen, sometimes that's difficult. So how are you going about keeping on?
So the history behind it, I've tested for battalion. This was my fourth exam. I've done really well in the testing in all four exams. The three previous, I tested number one, and this time I tested number two. Our exam process is pretty comprehensive, and it always seems to be like the separation between the top three candidates is literally within a point or two. And what it comes down to in my organization, it comes down to the fire chief takes the top three and picks who they feel is the most qualified and will do the best at the job. And so in 2016, while being number one on the list, I got passed up, and that was a really tough time. That freaking rocked my world, that out of all the time and effort and studying and education and just everything that I do, that really was like somebody fucking punched me in the face. So a really, really tough time dealing with it. And again, and we'll tie to the brothers of, you know, fools and everything. My wife, knowing that I was in a funk, you know, rallied a bunch of brothers. Zach King from down in Austin, Texas, he was in the area. My driver, Chad Berg, Brian Root from Seattle Fire, also a Puget Sound fool, and got a bunch of guys together and really helped me just kind of stay focused. So this time I scored number two. I knew going into it that I believe that I'm the most qualified. I have the most experience, time, but I knew that it was going to be an uphill battle, and the chief went with number one. And so, how do you process it? It's always disappointing when you feel like you are deserving of something and you've proven something. It's always disappointing, but I think what I'm trying to do is, you know, I know that I'm going to make it. I just don't know when. I also believe that there is a higher power above us, that there is just something more that I'm supposed to be doing at my current spot, or what I'm doing outside of being a BC. I won't compromise my belief system and my integrity to try to gain anything. So I'm going to stay true to the things that I believe in, because I think that the one day when I do make BC, I hope that the way that I'm viewed and as a leader is going to do well for the organization, whichever organization that is. What am I to do? I can't sulk about it and get all pissed off. That's not going to really show me as a good candidate or a good leader.
I think we've all witnessed that. You know, so I think it's to your credit, and to everyone else to take notice that will not be helpful, right?
Yeah, the good example is, and that's why I kind of set the stage with, I got passed up last year when I was number one, and I was disappointed. I mean, I was beyond disappointed. I was fucking pissed. And I tried to control my expression of how frustrated I was with the decision, and it wasn't 100% controlled.
And I don't think you're going to ever get anybody that's going to be, man, that's a perfect person. Man, he took that right on the chin like a champ. But you look at today, my experience from that year and then just this one. Am I disappointed? Absolutely. You always want to do well. But, you know, I package it up a little bit different. There's other things I can do that are helping me out. Family, life, everything else. I'm so grateful. You know, I'm blessed to have the job that I have. I'm blessed to have the family and friends that I have. And it'll happen one day. It'll happen. I mean, I've only been on the job for, well, January will be 30 years. So I've got, what, another 30 years to get promoted somewhere in there?
I love that. That's amazing.
But let me just, real quickly, just one of the things that's really been helping me out is I got into this LAFD Leadership Academy. Yes. Through the LAFD. And so we basically, the academy is studying, it's modeled after West Point's program on leadership that all the West Point cadets get. I think they get it in their junior year. And it is going to be 4 weeks total long of education. It's 1 week a month for 4 months. And what we're doing is we're breaking down the, I think it's 26 behavioral theories now. It used to be 24, 25. But, and what I'm finding as I'm going through it, I start week three here in another 2 weeks, is that no matter what, whatever the decisions are being made and how I'm viewed maybe by the fire chief that's making decisions or other chief officers, what has really helped me out is as I sit through these classes and I'm learning all these different behaviors and I'm learning all of these different theories on leading, all it's doing is it's confirming and reaffirming my track that I'm on, and that it really helps give me, you know, makes me feel good about myself and that I'm not compromising. I'm going to continue trudging forward. One day it will happen. I know it.
I love that. Rob, how long is that academy? What's the process for like getting involved? It's something that sounds super interesting.
The academy, LAFD does 3 academies a year. It is, like I said, it's a week long. Done once a month for 4 months. So I want to say the total amount of hours is like 140 some hour program. It is a graduate level program. At the end of your 4 months, you write a 20 page paper, academic style. So you kind of, you know, you gotta be able to do the work and do the research and do the reading. There's an incredible amount of reading, 100 pages, 150 pages a week. The lectures are being done by professors, being done by the assistant chiefs of various bureaus within the LAFD. One of the last classes, the psychologist from the LAPD, she's their psychologist for. I think LAPD has 2 psychologists that are on their staff, and she came in and gave us a 3-hour lecture on conflict management resolution, which was incredible. So how you get into it? I stumbled into it. I was at my desk in the training division, and I saw on the the iChiefs news bulletins that go out that Fairfax, Virginia was doing this leadership academy through West Point. I'm like, how the hell do you get into that? That sounds cool. And while doing a search on the internet, looking for more information on that, the LAFD one popped in, and you can just Google LAFD leadership, and it will it'll take you to their page, their website page. Down at the very bottom, as it explains the program, down at the very bottom, the current facilitator for it is Captain Craig Poulsen, and it has his email, and I emailed him, and he said, yeah, I'd love to have, you know, we take people from the outside into this program all the time, and filled out my application, sent in a resume, and had my training chief sign a letter saying that that I could do it. The class is free, of all things. It's a free class. It's incredible.
That's incredible.
So you have to fly down there. It's not a distance learning thing. You have to actually be there. So you have to fly down, stay down there. I mean, it's not cheap in that respect, but it's well worth it, in my opinion.
That's great. I heard about that when I was at the Las Vegas conference a couple of years ago, and some guys from SoCal, from other departments, not just LA, just speaking glowingly of it and how much they learned. And from that day, a couple years ago now, like, I know that is something that I will do one day. It sounds incredible. So really glad you're involved with that, dude.
Yeah, I'm hoping that I can bring this back.
Teach me something, yeah.
Of course. I'm hoping to bring it back in the county, maybe try to develop some type of company officer development program and use elements of this and some other things. And because really, when you look at it, I thought this is perfect for BCs. But in reality, when you start looking at the elements of how to understand people, how to apply theories to it, this is stuff that you need to know before you're even a company officer or as you become a company officer, because the one that's dealing more with people is the company officer. The battalion chief deals with a handful, whereas the company officer is dealing with more. So, I'd like to see getting this out a little bit more.
Excellent. Rob, you mentioned, you know, sitting at the desk at the training division. That's your position right now, is as a training officer at Snohomish. Something that I've been thinking, I'm really interested in operating in a capacity like that at some point in my career, and have been able to develop a pretty good relationship with my training chief, and have been speaking with a lot of guys around the country who operate in that kind of a capacity, whether it's at an academy level or just, you know, as a full-time training officer for their department or their region. Seem to get kind of some split answers. We have to learn a lot. We have so much to cover in the fire service from EMS, especially if you run fire-based EMS and paramedicine in your organization, to all the specialty teams, tech, ARF, dive, hazmat, all this, and then of course the next level firefighting skills that we all want to learn, and tactics and strategies and command and control. There's just so much to get our arms around. Is it possible in your position as a training officer or just in a training division, is it really possible to train people to a level of excellence from an organizational standpoint? Or are you just trying to train to a level of basic competence and it's kind of up to us to develop excellence?
Wow, that's a great question. I think so. First of all, the excellence is really gets established by example. So I consider myself a decent fireman, and I've put in the time and the effort. And so when this is my third time in the training division since I've been a company officer, and actually you could say the fourth time because I was in a succession training position for executive officer for a period of time too. But I believe, you know, I've talked to a bunch of the firefighters and officers, and they really like me in that role as a training officer because of my experience and being able to share. I hope that I'm setting a good example in how I am as a student of the fire service, and, you know, trying to share as much as I can. You know, I try not, as a company officer or as a training officer, we do company evaluations. That's one of my roles while I'm in the training division, is pretty comprehensive evaluation of every single company and member. Trying not to criticize their lack of ability or their lack of whatever, and trying to just highlight and letting those other companies that embrace that. You know, one of my big things that was just driving me nuts through the company evaluations this past year was fire ground tempo. And that, you know, I kept on saying, like, you guys are being evaluated, and I want to see you guys moving like you're on the fire ground. Well, you know what, hey Cap, we would do that when we're on the fire ground. I'm like, no, I mean, think of it as football. You know, when you're practicing for Friday night football game, you know, Monday, you're right. You guys are probably walking through it. You're choreographing everything. You're going through smooth. We don't want any injuries, you know, some light work. But when it comes to Wednesday or Thursday, probably Wednesday, you're at 75%. You know, you got to play at the game level so that you can have an idea of how you're going to perform when you're at game time. And I go, that's what I want to see from you guys. I want to see you guys working at 75% of what you would be on the fire ground. And so just being able to communicate that, showing through example, you know, when we're on the drill ground, I mean, I'm not walking around. I'm jogging around with them. You know, if you watch Pete Carroll from the Seahawks, you know, I think he's a great coach. He's just as enthusiastic, just as into the game as those guys. And he's in his 60s or maybe even in the 70s. And he is like as involved as everybody else. So he's setting a good example. So can we have excellence while you're working in the training division? I think you can. It's difficult, but you have a greater impact. The bigger the organization, though, the harder that can be. I mean, I can only imagine when I talk to my buddies at Seattle and they say, hey, we're going to do VES training. It's going to take us 2 months of training to get everybody done through it. And, you know, that would be tough. Whereas right now, you know, to do the company evaluations, it took me several months to do it because I'm trying to, you know, it was multiple hour evaluation per company and there was a lot that logistics that went behind it. But when we do nozzle training, you know, or like we got the new 7/8 tips, and so we're going to be going to some training with that. Yes. It's going to take us a few weeks to it's going to take us a few weeks to do the training, but we're going to be able to hit everybody. And we're just, you know, we're an eight station department with 140 150 guys and gals. But the bigger the department, the harder that can get to be able to do that. And so I don't know if I'm answering your question. I'm just kind of rambling.
Well, I mean, you started it with excellence is established by example. I wrote that down, and that's pretty fantastic. That's something that I think training officers everywhere can take to heart. It's something that I know that I want to see as someone who's being trained by training officers.
Here's the trouble with the training officer. And I'm this is a general statement, and I don't mean it to offend everybody. But what I hate about it is that, one, your most talented individuals don't want to go into the training division. Why is that? Because that means I have to come off a shift. That means that I'm no longer going on the calls. I'm no longer doing the work that I'm doing, you know, that I truly love. I get that. I go, so who goes into the training division? The guy that doesn't want to go on calls, or the guy that's not good at their skills, or gal, it's the wrong people in a lot of instances. It's the wrong people that are in the training division. They don't give a shit. And that example, that basically is, that's what sets the stage. So then you're there and you're going, okay, here comes Captain Fisher. Ooh, wow, he must have been on Facebook for the last 2 hours. And he's out of shape. And he drove his vehicle up. He's going to watch us from inside his vehicle so the air conditioning is on. You know, that doesn't fly. That doesn't fly. I don't care if you have a great message. You ain't going to get it through. But when Captain Fisher comes out and, you know, you're like, you know, he's been working hard. And puts his gear on. Yeah. You know, it's like, hey, let's pick up this hose. It's hustling to help pick up hose. Now, not every opportunity can I do that because I might be jotting some shit down. But, you know, you're helping them out. It's like, hey, we need to go over this other scenario. You're jogging over to the scenario. Those guys are like, what's wrong with him? They're like, there's nothing wrong. Setting a good example, you know? And that's why I use Pete Carroll, because I think when you watch him on the sidelines, he's running up and down the sidelines like he's a kid. And he's the oldest one there on that field. And that, to me, I think that's what makes, you know, Seattle have such a great team, because his players see his commitment to the team and see that, you know, kind of like what we were talking about when we started this. Everybody's the same. We're all the same here. Okay? We're all doing the same thing. We just have different roles.
Yeah. Well, I like that you're talking about the team. Obviously, we operate in a team dynamic day-to-day in the firehouse. It helps when people, administration, training officers, et cetera, come in and buy into the team idea. You as a company officer in the firehouse had an opportunity to work with the same guy for a very long time, a very cool guy, a guy I've got to meet, a very good fireman in Chad Berg, and establish a lot of team continuity. What's the, around the country, we have all kinds of different stuff. We have people who get assigned to a house. They work with the same people for a dozen years, 20 years. We get people who get moved around all the time, you know, shift bids every 6 months or whatever it is. What was, in your life, kind of anecdotally, the benefit of working with the same driver as a company officer for well over a decade?
Well, so I've been a company officer for 20 years, October, and Chad has been my driver. And I mean, obviously, I've been in the training division for a stint here and there, and been a temporary BC a couple times, but Chad has been my driver for, well, they separated us. This was funny. They separated us for 1 year because we were seen too often together. And we were, you know, when I see Rob, I always see Chad, because on our days off, we were training or doing whatever. That was terrible.
Right, I mean, that was a bad thing. Yeah.
Terrible example. Terrible example. So they separated us for 1 year, but I will consider that 1 year that he was still driving for me, but he's driven for me for 19 years. And the benefit is there, you know, it's like a yin and yang. There's a good and a bad to it. The good, we don't have to talk much. The bad, because we don't talk much, it makes it difficult sometimes for us to have a probie or a new guy, because, you know, we have to think, oh man, we got to talk these things out. It's, you know, we've got to make sure that they understand, you know, not just setting expectations, but just in the role of the day. There's a lot of things that we have similarities on. And then, you know, there's things that we've just never changed our opinion on things, and we are differing, you know. So just like with a relationship, you have your times where he really drives me nuts sometimes. And, but I do know his commitment to the job and to our company, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. We've done a ton of shit together, and there was on my post, you know, when everybody was like, "Hey, sorry about your, sorry about not getting promoted," and there, Cody jumped in with, "Hey, we, you know, we," I don't remember how it started, but it got to, you know, we all are together sleeping in the same bed, and he posted a picture of us instructing at, I don't know where we were at, and Cody, me, and I don't remember who the third person was in the, who was it? But anyways, so Chad starts posting, "Oh, I've slept with the boss here, 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 here." And he's not joking. These are places that we've gone to training where we shared the same bed. Yeah. You know, where we've gone to family events, you know, travel to Mazatlan, going to convention and all these things. There literally is probably 14 places. And when you think of that at work and away from work, that relationship is awesome. So I've learned a ton from Chad, and I've learned a ton about myself from our relationship. You know, I think it's great, but the problem is that, you know, I'll say that I'm a good company officer and Chad's a great driver. I'll tell you that. I know that for sure. By having two really good people together, it makes a really good unit. But what if you separated those guys after a period of time and you use that good company officer to develop other good drivers and good firefighters, and you separate that driver off and you develop another good company officer and good firefighters? And I think that's important, you know, the bigger picture. And, you know, we're getting to the time where, you know, when I come back to the line, I'm talking about maybe not going back to the truck. And that's just, Chad's just like, "I can't, there's something wrong with you, dude." And I think, you know.
You seem a light, Rob Fisher. Engine work.
It's not that I've.
Engine work. No.
Engine work. The BLS transport unit is what. but, you know, the. Well, hang on a second. I've seen the light for a long time. I think the truckie was the one that brought smoothbore nozzles at District 7 in 2007. So
slow clap for Rob Fisher. Slow clap.
Yeah. But anyways, But one of the benefits I said is like, look, if you get another company officer and a younger officer, think of how you can develop this individual.
Yeah.
And if I go somewhere else and, you know, we have 1.5 trucks in our department. The other truck is cross-staffed with an engine and never goes out. But if I went to an engine, a busy engine, and where we did a lot of work with the ladder truck, am I having an impact on truck company operations as an engine officer?
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that would be the benefit of, or that's the downfall of that relationship that has, you know, you've had a driver officer relationship for a long period of time. You know, there was our good buddy, Paul Guy, who had taken his life a few years ago, and him and his driver had, I want to say they had 17 years, a relationship. And Chad had worked for them, you know, as a fireman before he was driving for me. And I'd worked with those guys, you know, throughout our career. But that's the one thing that we compared ourselves to is like, do we have that same relationship? Are we accomplishing what those guys were accomplishing? Randy Weiss, who was Paul's driver, was the best driver that our department had at the time. And that's what we, you know, used as what we were shooting for. And I think we've done that.
That's great. Well, in all those years, I'm sure you guys have seen a lot of cool fires. I'm sure you've seen a lot of BS calls, and you probably kind of had your share of misadventures. So dig in the recesses of your mind, and I want to hear a story. Like, what's just the funniest or weirdest or craziest situation you guys have ever found yourselves in, whether on a call or at a conference or whatever?
Oh, man. And I know if Chad's going to listen to this podcast, he's going to say, I sure hope he brings up the time that we were trying to catch our flight at LaGuardia. We have had a lot of we've done some pretty crazy shit over the years. Been on some pretty cool calls. Probably, you know, we went to Oso together and we worked together in Oso. Chad's on the rescue team. So that's probably the biggest call impact wise that we've been on. We've been on deployments, wildland deployments together. We had the Street of Dreams fire. I want to say that was in 2006, where environmentalists, all these mansions that were being built out in the woods, this huge area, they lit like 6 of them on fire. So we literally had a cul-de-sac probably 6 mansions, you know, 5,000 plus square feet, lit on fire. You know, so we did that. That was an incredible call. We've been all over the place through education and training and taught, and which are awesome. But the one thing that I think the craziest thing we've done is we were coming back from, you know, this is after 9/11. We're coming back from our trip to FDNY. The brothers had taken care of us, got us in the van, you know, had a bunch of beers in the van for us. We had been out, we went to a funeral, if I remember correctly, that morning. So we had been hydrating quite early on, and we're going to the airport and we're hydrating on our way into the airport. Man, I had to go to the bathroom when we were stuck on whichever bridge it was. We got to the airport, we're trying to check in, our flight's getting ready to leave, we're a little bit behind, we're trying to find a bathroom, and I'm literally to the point where I have to, in my Class A, I have to piss myself. I mean, we cannot find a bathroom. The bathroom we find is closed, we're going berserk, and we can't get through, you know, because this is 9/11, so security is, you know, this is the time they were doing skin tests on you before you could get on a flight, you know, to see what your blood type is. And so you weren't going to go through security to get on the other side. And Chad's like, hey, I found something here. And so I go running over. And I thought it was the bathroom. No, it was the janitor closet. And in the dark, in our Class A's, shoulder to shoulder, we peed in the tub at the janitor's closet. Laughing and just having, and I know that story is going to come up at my retirement or his retirement. And it's one that we always laugh about, but that is probably the craziest thing that I've done with Chad outside of, you know, the fires that we've had a chance to rock.
That's great. I was on my way to a conference with Ben Rosenbaum, who is a guy who's been my mentor and one of my best friends. And he said, oh, what are you looking forward to most at this conference? And I said, it's something's going to happen that we could never make up, right? Like every time I go out to training, you know, you're going to meet someone who you had no idea who they were. You're going to have some great experience. And I love that, you know, you guys had this great trip to FDNY, but, you know, standing shoulder to shoulder peeing in the janitor's closet is something you'll never forget, I'm sure. All right, we're rolling, man. I think we're getting close to an hour and a half, so I'm going to ask you some of these kind of standard questions, a couple of these questions that I try to roll by most of the guests. Rob, if you could have every firefighter in America read one thing, a book, an article, a blog, what would it be?
Oh, there's no one thing. I'll first tell you that. But, you know, Brian Olson, he was really hitting this hard one time. And I had the document and I had never really sat down and read it. Because of Olson, who was also just for everybody that's listening, Brian Olson is one of the Brothers in Battle instructors. And
I've never heard of him. I don't know this guy.
Quiet. Awesome fireman, you know, that's so he's like, you gotta read this shit. He doesn't say shit very often, but you gotta read this shit from James Braidwood. And I'm like, that name sounds familiar. You know, James Braidwood he started the fire service, the way that we see the fire service today in England. And so he had written a number of different things, but the one thing was he's got a book. You can download it off the internet, and it's called Fire Prevention and Fire Extinction. And it's amazing. If you read this document, all those people that are thinking they're finding the new way of doing something, VEIS and all this other bullshit that's going on, nope, it was done in the 1800s. Even those that talk about calves, well, there was chemical engines back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, so there is when you read that and you see how, I mean, a totally different world. A lot of those things that we are doing today, you know, flow path and all this other shit that's just been repackaged. It was all there before. Nothing's new. So I'd say read that. You know, other things that I would suggest is anything that Mark Van Oppen does. I love his twists on things and his opinions on, you know, having the right mindset and you know, his commitment to the fire service.
I love Mark.
Yeah, great guy.
On the show very soon.
Oh, I can't wait. Chad Berg had written an article. It was probably in the mid 2000s, maybe 2007 or somewhere in there, and he titled it "So You Want to Be a Fireman." It's a great article that during the days of the blog before there was Facebook, that was all over the blogs, and I looked it up not too long ago, but it's on the internet, so if you type that in, it's always a good little article to read that kind of gives you perspective about it. And I think the last thing is I'm really getting into through my leadership. You know, there's one of the things I'm learning is that maybe it's not about teaching leadership is where we need to go, because we spend a lot of time and effort in trying to teach people to be leaders. And real simply, if you're a good person, good quality values, you're compassionate for your fellow man, you know, humankind, you have integrity and all these things, just about anybody can be a good leader. But there's this book out there. It's about followership, And basically, the author is Barbara Kellerman, and she's out of Harvard. And what she's challenging, she challenges that, you know, leadership, it's a science and an art, both. But in reality, you know, why does the military have such great leaders? Well, the military gets to do something that most corporations don't get to do, and even in the fire service, we don't get to do it to this level. They get to take the beginning and teach somebody to be a good follower. You know, when you join the military, you get your head shaved, you take all your rights away from you, you know, everything that you believe does not exist anymore, and they mold you into a really good follower. In turn, as you move through your years, you can develop into a good leader, because before you're a good leader, you have to be a good follower. So I'm really into her stuff, or into that book, been going in and out of it for a while, and I think it says a lot about where we need to make an adjustment here in the fire service, is, you know, trying to teach people to be good followers.
Excellent. Well, we will link to all of those in the show notes. I will be sure to pick up that book by Barbara Kellerman, because that sounds pretty interesting. And I definitely believe in that idea of followership, because it happens at every level. You're a company officer, you're a training officer, you get to be a leader, but you have folks to follow as well. If you haven't honed that followership skill, I don't know, can you really operate as a leader very well? We all answer to someone, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it kind of goes back to the setting the good examples that we were talking about earlier. If you want to be a good leader, you got to set a good example on how you're doing that. You are a good follower first.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. Very good. What actionable advice would you give the firefighter with an officer who refuses to train or only begrudgingly allows training?
Stay the course, I would say. You can always, there's a lot of stuff that you can learn on your own. If you're put into that situation where you don't have the support of the driver and the officer doesn't give a shit, and you're in a bad environment, and to some level, you can control your environment. So the first thing I would say is there's a ton of shit that you can do on your own. You know, when I listened to Yonkin's podcast about, he mentioned, hey, you can throw a pack, you can pull hose, you can reload hose. You know, there's all these little tiny things that you can do that will improve yourself. You can study, you can watch YouTube videos, you can start learning how to hash apart fires, you know, all on your own. Now, is it the best way? Absolutely not. It does not make for a very strong team, but it allows for you to stay engaged and be a student and learn. Reach out to brothers and sisters that are into training and learn from them. You don't have to learn everything from those that you're, you know, in your company. You can go outside. Spend a couple dollars on yourself. Invest into your career. You know, too many firefighters these days want to know why the department isn't sending them to training and why they're not paying them the overtime. I like overtime like everybody else, and I want to make sure I have a good wage. But why don't you spend a little bit of money on yourself and invest? Yeah, invest into yourself. I mean, I've gone to a number of conferences that my department never paid for on my own time. And yes, it's a sacrifice where I'm taking my time off away from my family to go somewhere. But do that. It's important that you invest into yourself, just like you invest time into your family, into your wife or your husband or your kids. Do that for your benefit. So go with it. I'm not going to take credit for this, because it was Josh Materia was the first one, good old Josh. He works for Seattle Fire on Rescue One. And if our firefighters put forth the time and effort that they put into their goddamn, you know, fantasy football teams, and just put half of that energy into being good firefighters, could you imagine how great our organizations would be?
Yep.
And that's not a hit on, oh, so now we can't do fantasy football. No, but when you know every stat on your player and where they're good and where they're not good, but you don't really know building construction, you don't really know, you know, the statistics behind where am I likely to find a victim. You know, well, it's in the bedroom. Well, you got that, but can you give me a little bit more to it? Well, you know, what's more important? I mean, it's in the bedroom. Like, But you can tell me their exact percentage of pass completions and how many interceptions. Come on. Put forth the effort into your job. And the people that you are serving deserve it. And your brothers and sisters that are working with you, they deserve it as well. So,
yeah, love it. Rob, what's something, a tactic, a mantra, or training method, something like that, that you have flipped on, that you've like done a 180 and you now view differently than you used to in the fire service?
Wow. Man. Well, I used to use combination nozzles and then, you know,
get rid of them.
And, you know, that's a great question. I know that there's something out there and it's just nothing's coming to mind. I think it's not so much what's the one thing, but just keeping yourself open to always, you know, being a student, trying to learn. You can't implement everything that you're out there learning. You can't be all things that are going on in the fire service today, but being able to take something, and you can use the nozzle project that I worked on in 2006. It's like we had to look at what was the problem going on in our organization, and we had combination nozzles, we had automatic nozzles, we had zero smoothbore nozzles, and we were able to implement a change in our nozzle package and our hose loads. I mean, we went away from pre-connects and we went to bulk or static beds. So there's a lot of things that I learned early on in the fire service. Like, you know, I didn't know that there was really a bed outside of a pre-connected bed, but the more you got yourself out and you started learning what others are doing outside of you and you got away from the core of your organization, you know, and it's trying to stay away from inbreeding, but you are able to pull some experiences outside. It's like I learned a ton of stuff. So my world has flipped so many times, I'm dizzy, I guess I could say. And I just couldn't even pinpoint one single thing. But, you know, here, I'll tell you one. When we had a Quint, I wasn't a big Quint fan. I wanted to be a truckie like everybody else. You know, just the pump shouldn't be on the apparatus. And that, you know, a good truck company is a ladder truck only. And I would say that in certain applications, in certain organizations, and the right configuration, Quints are very, very, very effective. You know, there's a good and a bad to them, but they can be very effective. So when I was anti-Quint before, I'm not anti-Quint. I'm just more like it works in some areas. It doesn't work in everywhere.
Right. Well, good. I want to give you a chance to talk about that a little bit before we wrap up. I mistakenly called you a subject matter expert. We'll call you a passionate student of Quints and truck work in the suburban landscape. Give me a little background on your experience with Quints, and let's talk about your FDIC class.
Okay, well, our ladder truck, when I first came on the job, we had West States T-Bolt. T-Bolt was a company out of Canada, no longer exists anymore. And it was a Quint of the early days. It was an 87. We spec'd out the 1996 LTI, Simon Duplex LTI Quint that we had up until we just got our new truck. And as firefighters, we didn't have much control over changing anything. Basically, the chief made the decisions on how things were going to be made, but we had a little bit of influence. And so worked on that. The department decided they were going to staff it primarily out of just a need. It wasn't because, hey, we want to have a staff ladder truck. We opened up a station. We didn't have enough engines. So they said at that station, we're going to put the ladder truck that has a pump and a tank. And their whole, like, okay, use the aerial when you need to, but you're an engine is basically the approach. I was really getting into truck operations right after I got promoted in 97 and started teaching with Firetown and, you know, started learning more about truck operations and how do I, with this, you know, hermaphrodite style apparatus, how do I make these two jive? And then the benefit of truck operations or fire ground support operations and how do we implement those into our organization? So started working to try to bring those two together. And, St. Louis was probably the biggest Quint operator back in the late 80s. And, you know, so looked in how they were doing it. And the fire chief at the time said, you know, St. Louis can do it. I go, but the difference is, Chief, is that we have one quint and they have, you know, they basically turned their entire fleet into quints of some 50 pieces of apparatus. So that started my journey in trying to learn it and what can we do, what we cannot do. And we went, basically we went heavier on the truck side and started to figure out how we can function more as a truck first and an engine second. I took the, basically took the motto of, you know, in my organization at the time we had six companies, five of them were engines and one of them was this quint. And, you know, should I be a truck first or an engine first? And typically I said, well, you arrive first, get water on the fire right away. And my argument was, well, depending on the size of the building determines my apparatus placement. If I'm a truck, I have to place here. If I'm an engine, I place there. And why would I want to be an engine when I have five other ones coming behind me, when I have zero trucks coming behind me? Maybe I should be a truck first and an engine second. So that started creating some, you know, parameters of when we should stretch and when we shouldn't stretch. And, you know, towards the end there, you know, we'd get a number of fires that we'd be first due in, and probably I'd say 90% of the time we wouldn't stretch on the fire because we were supported by these engines that were right around us. So we'd literally get on scene, position as a truck. And by the time I can assess it and get somewhat of a walk around or whatever it was, the engine was coming down the block, you know, I have no problem allowing them to have the stretch, to have the fire attack. My commitment is into all the other support activities that go on the fire ground. And so I tell them, it's, you know, it's floor two, Charlie Delta Corner. You guys are going to be fire control. We're going to support you with the search or ventilation or whatever our need was. And that kind of led to the class. You know, at FDIC, I teach this class. It's called, it's slipping my mind exactly how I'm wording it because I've changed it a few times. But basically, it's, you know, single truck operation or single quint operations in the suburban fire department. So it's basically dealing with the majority of the suburban departments or the majority of the departments that have quints are typically they have one single quint truck. It's a stepping stone for becoming a truck, or it's just a, you know, an ISO rating so that they can make sure they have it. And so just giving them some things to think about, how to spec out your rig, things to think about and how your operations go. And sometimes they have to, you know, you just absolutely have to stretch the line and put water on the fire. And sometimes you don't. And then, we since specced out a tillered, ladder, and, we got rid of the quint idea and we went with a stored calf system, which was completely different, but we've changed our model. So it's been great. This is my, I got accepted again. So this will be my fifth year presenting at FDIC in 2018.
Excellent. That's really cool. I think that's a nice niche that you found because it is a reality for a lot of us. I ride a quint myself, and we deal with all of those same issues. And, you know, everyone kind of has a little bit of a different take on it. So I think coming from a guy with your experience, if people listening ride a quint, if they have a quint in their department, I think it'd be a really valuable thing for them to hear your class at FDIC. So I'm glad you're doing that. All right, Robbie. We are rocking. We're approaching 2 hours, so let's wrap this up. I'm starting to feel like you and Chad trying to get on your flight. So, Rob, if people want to find you, they want to ask questions about fools or quints or like where the best places to eat are in Seattle or tips for taking selfies, how can they get a hold of you?
You know, I'm surprised you didn't even ask me about what I was having for dinner. You know, what's the wine?
Oh, yeah, no. Some guy on my Facebook Live wanted me to ask you. His name was Fob Risher. he wanted me to ask you what your favorite wine was.
Oh man, I'm surprised. I was waiting for that from the very very beginning. I was like, okay, Rob, what's for dinner tonight, and what are you going to be drinking with it? But, you can get a hold of me on Facebook, Rob Fisher 72, Twitter, Rob Fisher 72. There's a link. There's a common theme here. Instagram, Rob Fisher 72. You can email me robfisher72@gmail.com. God, there's a theme there.
This is a good, you understand personal branding.
Yeah. I understand personal brand, but yeah, I'm always open to the message. You know, I try to, I don't want to say I'm super busy and, you know, I get inundated by questions, but I do get a lot of messages. I've been busy the last year with a lot of things. And so sometimes I get somebody that sends me a message through Facebook, and it takes me like a week to answer. And I see, I'm like, shit, sorry, dude. And I always have to start it off. Sorry, brother. My fault. I've just been busy, and I saw it, and I just forgot about it the last few days, and I'm just now answering your question. But yeah, you can reach me on all of those things. You can see me at I'll be with Brothers in Battle at the Firemanship Conference February this next year. Looking forward to it. I'll be at FDIC. I'm going to be at Firehouse World in Nashville in October. Rosecrans Symposium in September and in October. Brothers in Battle will be at the Mile High Conference in Colorado. So I'll be a lot of places.
All right, very good. So if someone approaches you at a social after the day of hands-on training, what type of beer or wine should they offer to buy for you, Rob?
Well, if we're doing a lot of brotherhood, it's going to be I'm into IPAs, I love Guinness, and I like whiskey. If we're sitting down to eat dinner or, you know, going to have some snacks, it's, you know, Carmenere is one of my favorites, which is not a usual wine that most people are aware of. Lemberger is also, it's not just a cheese, it is a wine. Those are unusual wines you don't see very often, but you always go big, so you can go with the Cabernet, and I'm happy.
All right, very cool. Rob, thanks for being here. Thanks for taking the time. Thanks for being a good brother. I appreciate it, and I hope to catch up with you very soon.
Well, I just want to say, Stephen, just thank you for what you're doing. When you had this idea that you started up a while ago and you were trying to, man, I love the concept, and I think it's great that what you're giving back to the fire service, and you know, and you're trying to archive a lot of these things. I'm humbled to be part of, you know, great firemen that you've already interviewed. Corporal Randy, I mean, you can't beat that. Gary Lane and you know, Yonkin, and so I'm privileged to be in that group, and I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. You're more than a brother, you know. So it's just great to be on the show, and I just to close things off, because I know you got your ending. I just say to everybody out there, you know, don't be basic. Be something better than, and no matter what you're doing, it's in the fire service or in your life. But you know, my wife had posted on her Instagram thing, and it was perfect. It says, "You can't do epic shit with basic people." So just don't be basic. Be something better.
Don't be basic. Rob, thanks for sharing that and everything else with us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, brother.
Thank you. See ya.
I'm Brian Brush, and we're getting down to the brass tacks and hard facts of interior fire streams. Oftentimes, fire stream evaluations are performed out in a parking lot or in a wide open space where we're really analyzing that stream quality over a greater distance. We've moved to the inside of the structure now to put you in the true context of our interior fire attack.
The hard facts are that a purely exterior stream evaluation places too much weight on stream quality. When we move inside with an active line and tight quarters, we can evaluate water application, nozzle handling, and air movement, the more important factors of an interior fire attack. So when you conduct your fire stream evaluations, don't just grade a nozzle on the beauty of a stream in a parking lot and the spray and pray qualities. Move inside and evaluate the nozzle's hit and move abilities.